Across the Pacifica Network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, August 20, 2003. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Today marks the day in Venezuela when opposition groups are constitutionally allowed to begin the campaign for a recall referendum of President Hugo Chavez. Chavez supporters say the opposition are not acting constitutionally. San Francisco media activists score a victory for low-power radio and against the FCC. And in the final part of our cyber surveillance series, we look at how Microsoft and the US government are combining to spy on Microsoft users. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan says the UN will continue their work in Iraq despite yesterday's devastating bombing of the World Body's offices in Baghdad. Hedda Rizvi reports from the United Nations.
Kofi Annan said it was too early to say who was behind the bombing, which killed at least 20 people, including a UN special representative. He blamed the US-led occupying forces for failing to protect the UN offices in Baghdad, saying that they were broadly responsible for security in Iraq. Independent UN observers say the suicide bombing of the UN offices was an assault on an institution increasingly perceived as a political mouthpiece of the United States, and that many Iraqis see the UN as part of the occupying forces. In the wake of yesterday's bombing, it is expected that some members, including Britain, may push the Security Council for an expanded role in Iraq, a demand which is unlikely to be accepted by the United States. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Hedda Rizvi at the United Nations.
Israel has stopped any more withdrawals from the West Bank and imposed full closure on West Bank towns. Mohammed Galghini reports from Gaza.
The Palestinian Minister of Internal Security met with his police and security chiefs to discuss the Palestinian reaction to the suicide bombing. They decided to put the Palestinian security forces on high alert and wait for a cabinet and presidential decision. The Palestinian Authority held Israel responsible for the escalation because of, quote, the series of violations of the truce and the roadmap, but they also laid responsibility on Hamas and Islamic Jihad because what happened in Jerusalem last night was, quote, inexcusable. The Palestinian cabinet met today and established a series of recommendations that will be raised with President Arafat and the PLO and Fatah Central Committees tonight, according to Palestinian Information Minister Nabil Amr.
We will go ahead and we will continue our measures to enforce the oneness of the authority and the rule of law. Any Israeli military reaction will obstruct our measures and will only lead to further deterioration.
There is high speculation that this will lead to a crackdown on Hamas and Islamic Jihad. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mohammed Ghalayini in Gaza.
The U.S. Attorney General is touring the United States. Robert Flaxman reports from D.C.
John Ashcroft kicked off a national defense of the Patriot Act in Washington, the first of more than a dozen speeches the Attorney General is scheduled to make in support of the Act's provisions. The Patriot Act, an anti-terrorism policy passed in the wake of the September 11th attacks, has drawn fire from all over the country, with three states and 150 local governments formally objecting to the act. Ashcroft says the law's protection of America is an end to protect freedom.
We have used these tools to prevent terrorists from unleashing more death and destruction on our soil. We have used these tools to provide the security that ensures liberty.
On Monday, Astoria, Oregon became the 150th local government to declare their city a civil liberties safe zone. Critics of the Patriot Act say that it infringes on personal freedoms and the constitutional right to privacy. The Justice Department claims the law is misunderstood and that Ashcroft's barnstorming will clear up many of the misconceptions opponents have. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Robert Flaxman.
Veterans of the 1991 U.S.-led war with Iraq filed a class-action lawsuit in a New York district court yesterday against banks and corporations they say are liable for illnesses sustained from exposure to chemical weapons during the fighting. From Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, Jackson Allers reports.
The lawsuit contends 11 companies sold Saddam Hussein's government the precursors for chemical weapons during the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. These chemical munitions were exploded during the attacks in the first U.S.-led Gulf War, exposing more than 100,000 U.S. servicemen and women to clouds of chemicals they say has manifested in what is now called Gulf War Syndrome. In addition, the lawsuit contends that 33 mostly European banks provided letters of credit for Iraq's purchase of these chemical weapons precursors. Kenneth McCallion is one of the attorneys representing the Gulf War veterans in the class action lawsuit.
Everyone knew, who knew anything about what was going on there, that the purchase of chemicals by the Iraqi regime would be used for weapon purposes.
The lawsuit seeks unspecified damages and would direct the defendants to pay for a medical monitoring system for Gulf War I veterans and their children. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jackson Allers.
California has passed a landmark financial privacy law. KPFA's Christopher Martinez has more from Berkeley.
The new financial privacy bill gives consumers more control over their personal information. It makes banks and insurance companies get permission before selling or sharing private information about their customers. The financial industry and its allies in the state legislature have been fighting the measure for 4 years. Opponents finally backed down after advocates gathered more than 500,000 signatures to put an even tougher measure on the ballot if the bill failed. Governor Gray Davis, who's facing a recall election in October, has said he'll sign the bill whether he's governor for 7 weeks or 3 years. State Senator Jackie Speier is the bill's author. She hopes the bill will be a model for national legislation.
There's been the civil rights movement. There's been the women's movement, there's been the sexual revolution, and now there is a privacy revolution, not just in the state, but across the country. And this, I believe, is the first salvo that will be heard, hopefully, in the halls of Congress.
For Free Speech Radio News in Berkeley, I'm Christopher Martinez.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
Today marks the day in Venezuela when opposition groups are constitutionally allowed to begin the campaign for a recall referendum of President Hugo Chavez. Yesterday marked the halfway point of Chavez's term. However, the campaign begins amidst a cloud of controversy over whether the petition for the referendum is valid. Major demonstrations by the opposition today and by Chavez supporters on Saturday show that the political polarization in Venezuela continues. Greg Wilpert has the story from Caracas.
These are the sounds of Venezuela's opposition celebrating with fireworks and demonstrations last night at midnight, because as of that hour, exactly halfway through President Chavez's current term in office, the opposition may begin the process of organizing a recall referendum against the president. Alejandro Amas, one of the opposition leaders who submitted 3 million signatures collected last February in favor of the recall referendum, explains the opposition's motivations.
In an impeccable act of the peaceful and democratic will of the Venezuelan citizenry, these signatures represent 5, 6, 7 million Venezuelans who manifest their will to peacefully resolve the country's crisis via a recall referendum. Why the recall? Because the recall is a means for a peaceful reconstruction of the country, for the reconciliation of Venezuelans, for advancing on the way to peace.
Once 20% of the electorate signatures are collected, the country's National Electoral Council must verify the signatures and call for a vote. If the signatures are valid, the referendum must take place within 3 months of the submission of the petition, meaning a vote could take place as soon as November 2003. Manuel Cova, the leader of the Oppositional Union Federation, describes the process.
The opposition concluded that the objective is to submit the signatures, because with the presentation of the signatures to the Electoral Council, the legal mechanisms for the referendum are activated, which is the most important thing that has happened today. At 6 a.m., the countdown began. The law says that the Electoral Council has 30 days to verify the signatures.
However, there is much controversy over whether the signatures are valid. Government supporters, such as Marisol Plaza, the government's defense attorney, argues that the signatures are invalid because they were collected in February, long before the halfway point of the president's term in office.
Entonces, ¿qué es lo que se ha hecho en la actualidad? ¿Qué fue lo que se hizo hoy?
What was done today? Signatures were presented, which were collected earlier during a completely different period in February. Then these stored signatures were presented today, since the right to present them begins today. So there's an abusive use of citizens' will. The signatures are not valid because they were collected a long time ago, because today is when the collection of signatures for the referendum should begin.
No se han solicitado en el momento porque hoy es cuando debe comenzar a recogerse la firma para el referéndum.
Government spokespersons have repeatedly argued that the government would respect the recall referendum, but only if all legal procedures are properly fulfilled. However, government supporters see the government at a disadvantage because practically all of the private mass media are engaged in an all-out campaign against the president. Samuel Moncada, a political analyst and chair of the history department at the country's largest public university, explains.
Manipulación grotesca.
There has been a grotesque manipulation of information. In these past few days, for example, until this morning, there had been no large demonstration for the past few months. The news programs, however, show leaders of the opposition speaking with demonstrations as the backdrop. But these demonstrations were last December and January, and they put them as if they were yesterday or the day before. They are falsifying information. This is not the mood of the street.
These next few weeks and months thus are the beginning of a massive government campaign to prove to those swayed by opposition arguments that the government has achieved a lot in the past 3 years, so that if there is a referendum, the government will win it decisively. Greg Wilpert reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Caracas, Venezuela.
San Francisco media activists scored a victory yesterday against the FCC and the forces of media consolidation. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors passed a unanimous resolution in support of local pirate radio station San Francisco Liberation Radio, or SFLR, and called for an increase in media diversity and a rollback of the FCC rule relaxation decisions of June 2nd. Sarah Olson reports from Berkeley that this is the first decision of its kind nationwide to support a local pirate radio station.
Station DJs went to the Board of Supervisors asking that the city government of San Francisco throw its weight behind the community station San Francisco Liberation Radio, or SFLR. Matt Gonzalez is the president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors and authored the resolution supporting SFLR.
For us, it just seems very natural to not be frightened of speech and speech from, in this case, really the little guy, the sort of alternative press that's trying to get a message out to folks. So I think it's really very beneficial, very, very important.
The San Francisco City Council decision also calls on Congress to repeal the recent FCC Act to eliminate the television newspaper cross-ownership ban and raise the national market ownership cap on television outlets to 45%, among other decisions that a growing number of media activists, union groups, and local, state, and federal government officials say will damage the media diversity in this country.
This is Mumia Abu-Jamal on San Francisco Liberation Radio, 93.7 FM.
SFLR was visited by the FCC on July 2nd. The FCC delivered a letter notifying the station that it was operating without a license and fining the operators $17,000. SFLR has operated without a license from the FCC for over 10 years. During that time, the low-power FM station attempted to bring underrepresented community voices to the airwaves, including voices from homeless, youth, queer, and feminist communities. SFLR co-founder Richard Edmondson.
SFLR grew out of the Food Not Bombs movement, and the station was put on the air in 1993, very specifically and very purposely, in response to the arrests of Food Not Bombs activists, which had been ordered by two previous mayors of San Francisco.
Today, SFLR producers and DJs are intent on reclaiming what they say already belongs to the public. Sonny Angulo is co-host of the SFLR Nightly News Show.
It's amazing to me that within all this talk about globalization and privatization of resources within our global community, we have neglected to realize that media, that our airwaves, that our, you know, televisions, that our newspapers are just as much a natural resource and just as much the people's property as water or as electricity or as healthcare.
San Francisco chapter and local community groups such as Not in Our Name and Bay Area Radical Women supported the resolution at the San Francisco City Council. In a letter to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, the Worker Reporter Collective of Free Speech Radio News also endorsed the resolution. Jeff Perlstein is the executive director of San Francisco-based media advocacy group Media Alliance. He says the actions of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors must be considered within the context of the national discourse about media ownership and diversity.
This is such a crucial moment, and really there's unprecedented attention to and concern over the hyper-consolidation of our media landscape. Now that a handful of massive corporations are dominating 80% of what the American people see and hear, and the FCC has just approved rules that are going to make that consolidation even tighter and really narrow the voices even further.
Peter Frank of the National Lawyers Guild sees this resolution giving renewed vigor to the media activist movement.
Well, I think the support of the Board of Supervisors and the fact this was a unanimous resolution was very important and will be important in giving heart to the low-power radio movement and both other people coming back on the air as pioneers doing civil disobedience and in terms of Congress considering what to do about allowing more stations and breaking up some of these illegal monopolies.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sarah Olson in San Francisco.
As the nation's attention focuses on whether or not same-sex marriage should be put into law or made constitutionally illegal, hate crimes continue to mount towards lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. In Washington, mourners have been holding a vigil for Bea Evangelista, a transgender woman who was murdered last Saturday. It was the third murder of a transgender person in the past year, and vigils have occurred every day this week. Selena Musuta reports from Washington, D.C.
Last night, for the second consecutive day, approximately 75 people gathered for a vigil in the Columbia Heights area of Washington, D.C. to commemorate the life of Bea Evangelista, a 25-year-old Latina transgender murder victim. Early Saturday morning, 22-year-old Antoine D. Jacobs shot Evangelista when he found that she was not biologically female after he paid for her sexual acts. Activists, community members, friends, and family spoke at the vigil. Like many of the speakers, Ruby Bracamonte, a longtime friend of Evangelista and organizer of the vigil, explained some of the reasons transgender people end up doing sex work.
There's a lot of prejudice against transgender individuals. Sometimes things are a little bit more difficult because from the younger years, we didn't have the opportunity to stay in school. We were harassed. We didn't have the opportunity to get full education. So now in our 20s, in our 30s, we cannot expect to get good paying jobs when we couldn't stay in school from the harassment. We really need to focus on that.
Evangelista, an immigrant from Guatemala, had been known to be homeless at times. Bracamonte said transgender people have created a strong community in D.C., yet are still not treated humanely.
You can go into a place, and as soon as you're perceived as being transgender, you cannot get a job, even if it's a McDonald's. You cannot get an apartment, even if you have the money to pay for it. You cannot sit in a restaurant unless people are looking at you like you're some alien. It's inhuman what people are doing.
Lisbeth Melendez, Director of Community Education and Training for IEGO, the National Latina Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Organization, describes the importance of community education in preventing acts of violence.
Do we believe that punishment as in a form of legislation is what is needed? You know what? No. I think as a community, we need to observe and have an understanding about what does it mean to live with dignity when you're a trans individual. And it's beyond punishing the perpetrators, but educating community as a whole to actually avoid and prevent hate. We continue to look at punitive measures in order to respond to these issues. And the reality is that when we take a look at who the victims are, the perpetrators are, education will go so much further.
This is the third homicide of a transgender person in the D.C. area in a year. The killing has been classified as a hate bias motivated crime, which carries a longer prison sentence under Washington, D.C. law, though the district does not protect the civil rights of transgender people. As most states do not include gender identity in their hate crimes policies, transgender rights groups vow to fight for legislation to be implemented. In the United States, with more than 13 reported transgender-related murders this year, 2003 is keeping up with the deadliest year for transgender people, which was 2002. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Selena Masuda. Thanks to Ingrid Drake for help on this report.
Microsoft today announced that its Office Systems 2003 was complete and had been sent out to manufacturers. Over the past few months, the computer giant has been battling the so-called blaster virus, a tricky virus that's affected business and consumers alike. This comes as the BBC released a report yesterday detailing how Microsoft Office contains spying capabilities when sending documents. China recently expelled the use of Microsoft as the operating system has been used by the US government to monitor users as part of its national security. Simba Russo brings us this final report of our special three-part series on cyber surveillance and the freedom of public access to information on the internet.
The information technology age has revolutionized the manner in which we communicate and operate on a daily basis. It has provided us with wireless data networks, encryption abilities, the global internet, and the ability to monitor and consolidate vast amounts of information from around the world. Since 9/11, the Bush administration has taken various steps to unleash its newest weapon against terrorism, technology.
The military had its idea of a worldwide computer network that really would be able to survive a large-scale war.
Mike DiFilippo, an independent electrical and robotics engineer, explains how the internet got its start.
Because we saw how reliable it was when, during the fall of the Soviet Union, the best news reports and information, there was no more phones, there was no more satellite services or news services for a while, but the best information came from the internet.
In response to the events of 9/11, President Bush quickly extended the anti-terrorism law to include cyber terrorism as a federal offense and allow law enforcement agencies spying capabilities through the use of the internet and everyday computing. One of those tools developed by the FBI was known as Carnivore, which has recently been renamed DCS-1000. Frank Beecham, a technology writer, explains how this device, which has been installed on all Windows 2000 and XP systems, is used to monitor users.
Carnivore is the government's way of going through the huge amount of data that circulates through the internet on a given day, and somehow using fragments of that through surveillance to construct scenarios of threats to security.
Microsoft has established itself as a monopoly in the computing world. Critics of the company's practices have accused the corporation of seeking to control not only the internet, but television and radio streaming, software use, and operating systems around the world. Recently, a new virus has affected computers due to a flaw in the emailing software. This virus, known as the blaster or the worm, was passed from the update site of Windows, which has recently encouraged a new patch to protect users.
Windows is notoriously insecure and bloated and huge and such a big project, I don't even think Microsoft knows how it works anymore.
Lee Azzarello, a computer programmer, explains how Windows' emailing system allows your address book to be opened and how the worm then sends its virus to everyone in your address book and passes it through the system.
This worm exploits this thing called the RPC, which stands for remote procedure calls, remote being the keyword, in that you could remotely call certain programs on your operating system. And it gets at this RPC system over the internet.
Microsoft Office's latest product, 2003, comes equipped with XML capabilities. XML is the flexible and widely adopted internet protocol. It allows Word, Excel, and PowerPoint to be saved in XML format so that items can be shared easily between the different softwares. Outlook 2003 is advertised to have, quote, network awareness, which means that Microsoft can monitor the connection between users of the network. Sounds like a great deal? Well, the British government has discontinued the use of Microsoft systems for Adobe Acrobat, stating that the Word document that created the dossier revealed hidden information of the names who worked on it and the changes that were made. Again, technology writer Frank Beecham.
Microsoft Word, the format since 1997, virtually every document made in Microsoft Word contains hidden letters and symbols and fragments of data from the user's computer that can reveal anything from confidential information to social security numbers to names and addresses.
This week, Attorney General John Ashcroft launches his nationwide campaign to expand anti-terrorism surveillance powers. This as Microsoft announced today that Office 2003 will be available for consumers by October 2003 with expanded protections. For Free Speech Radio News in New York, I'm Simba Russo.
A controversial weapons incinerator has now been running almost 2 weeks in Anniston, Alabama. The Army says its $1 billion incinerator is the safest way to destroy the stockpiled of Cold War-era nerve and blister agent. But hundreds of Southerners who converged on Anniston this past weekend to protest say the incinerator is unsafe and unhealthy and emphasize the complicity between the Army, its contractors, and Alabama's politicians. Some 60% of the residents of Calhoun County remain opposed to the incinerator and want a chance to consider alternatives. Jack Hickey reports from Anniston.
No more burning! No more life! Better way! Neutralize!
The crowd at Anniston, Alabama's Zinn Park is fed up. The Army asserts that incinerating 2,300 tons of chemical weapons is safe. Opponents call the move, occurring in working class, largely African-American West Anniston, a human sacrifice zone. Craig Williams started the Chemical Weapons Working Group and has organized for Sound Science and Community Voice for over 20 years. He's been reaching out to Anniston for more than a decade.
Four communities get choices, four communities don't. You'll never guess what the demographics are of the four communities that didn't.
Right.
They're black, they're poor, they're indigenous. Is it just that some communities have had an opportunity to compare incineration to other disposal options and this community hasn't? Is that justice?
No!
It is an abomination that this country, that this government, that this army, that this program know that the monitors they have in place over there are going to take 10 to 20 minutes when there are updated monitoring capabilities that can do that in real time in 10 seconds or less. And you know why the Army doesn't want to use them?
Yeah.
Because they know if they use good monitors, they're going to be detecting agent coming out of that stack every 15 minutes.
John McCown is national co-chair of the Sierra Club's Environmental Justice Program.
I'm thinking about 1930, when the state of Alabama and the United States government deliberately poisoned black men
yes.
with the syphilis virus
yes.
and watched them suffer for 40 years.
Right.
Well, I draw a parallel between what happened back in 1930 up until 1970 to what's going on right here in Anniston, Alabama
yes.
today. My ancestors spent many years on the plantation, and I want you to know right now that the plantation has been expanded.
Right.
The plantation now has Asian and Pacific Islanders. It's got low-income white folks here in Anniston, Alabama. It's got poor yeah. black folks here in Alabama. Suffering people all over this country right now are on the plantation. And the slave master today is corporate America
all right.
and the U.S. government.
Yeah. Come on.
Annistonians in the crowd see the situation from the inside. Tanya Sanders tells of the personal toxic burden.
Right now, it's real contaminated. I mean, we go from the incinerator to the PCB, you know. What's next? That's what we ask, how we're going to raise our children in this community when there's so much contamination here. So I have relatives, in-laws have died, you know, from cancer, and now we know why.
Nicole Seymour discusses the flaws in the government's promises of maximum protection.
They've done a quick fix, and there's so many holes in the solution. You tell people to come out and get masks. Well, no, you should be going to them. I don't have a mask, you know? People have to work. They haven't even looked at the problems.
And the Reverend Leon Staples sees the military money connection in this city.
I went through the whole Korean conflict. We were there because of big business. They make a lot of money when you have war because they can build military hardware. That's one of the ways they become millionaires and billionaires, on the back of poor folks and on the back of building military hardware.
From Anniston, Alabama, this is Jack Hickey with Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.